Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. This is an amazing statistic. Afghanistan has a larger percentage of its national legislative body than the U.S. does. Women are represented in this country. 19.4% of our members of Congress were female. In Afghanistan, 28%. Of their national legislators are female. The U.S. ranks 83rd out of 137 countries for its share of women holding office in a national legislature. Some of this is due to gender quotas. Argentina passed a law in the 1990s aimed at advancing women's representation. Dozens of other countries have taken the step of doing just that. Our guest this hour, Diana O'Brien of Indiana University, looked at 15 years of data on local leadership appointments in Sweden's largest political party, focusing on political leadership before and after the Swedish Social Democratic Party imposed a gender quota on 290 municipal branches of government. We're going to be talking about that study this hour of the program with Professor O'Brien and welcoming phone calls, too. She's assistant professor of political science at Indiana University, and her main research and teaching interests are women in politics, political institutions, European politics, and several other areas. She is the author of Representing Women, Presence, Power, and Policy. For you to join the conversation, the phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor O'Brien, thank you very much for being with us today. Hello.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to talk with you and your listeners about quota policies and women's political representation more broadly.
I am too. And I think probably people heard me talk about Afghanistan and all the countries that have gender quotas and were pretty amazed to even hear that that exists. Can you tell me a little bit about the history?
Sure. So when we think about quota policies, we're really thinking about policies aimed at promoting the inclusion of historically underrepresented groups. So there are a lot of forms that quota policies can take, but in politics, the most common type of quota is a policy that's aimed at increasing the presence of women in national legislatures. So since the 1990s, we've seen a tremendous growth in the adoption of quota policies. So we now have actually over 75 countries and more than 130 political parties worldwide that have adopted some sort of quota policy aimed at increasing women's representation in national politics.
Mm-hmm. And it's really amazing because we talk so often about why it is that in the United States we have so few women in our national legislature, and rarely do we talk about quota policies or do a comparison with other countries in the world. We just leave it as, well, this is the way it is and these may be the reasons, but it's true that something could be done about this.
That's absolutely right. We don't typically think about quota policies in the United States. I mean, I think the one example that I can think of in politics is, of course, that the Democratic Party does mandate a 50-50 quota in delegate selection. So when we have the upcoming Democratic National Convention, 50% of this delegates will be women. But beyond that, we don't think about quotas in U.S. policy and U.S. politics. And that's some combination of, in some part, public opinion towards affirmative action policies,
yes,
but in large part, actually, because of the way that we do candidate selection in this country and because of our electoral system.
Mm-hmm. So your study looks specifically at a number of years of data from Sweden. Is that right?
That's correct. So we exploit the fact that we have really nice, detailed information about local-level politicians in Sweden to think about what are the medium and long-term consequences of enacting quota policies for women's access to other positions of political power. In our case, we're thinking about party leaders who you can think of as being like mayors in the Swedish context.
And you studied the Swedish Social Democratic Party. When they initially did quotas, was it 50% of candidates they wanted to have as women, or was it less than that? What was the initial quota?
So the policy that we're looking at is a 50-50 quota. So it's every other one for a woman. And so actually what the National Party asked its local parties to do was to create two lists, a list of male politicians and a list of female politicians for elected office. And then after they created these two lists, the parties were told to zip the list together so that every other candidate would be a woman. So if the first person, if the first candidate for the party was a man, the second would be a woman. If the third was a man, the fourth would be a woman, and so on.
And do you know, were there any problems in Sweden or other countries that you're aware of in finding enough women who wanted to do this and were available to step in and run for office?
I think that's such an interesting question, and one of the most important points that's raised during quota debates. So almost any time we're debating introducing a quota policy, whether it's for local office, whether it's for corporate boards, there's this concern about finding a sufficient number of qualified women for the post. And so what we've found time and time again is once you tell political parties or corporate boards that they need to find qualified women, they do so. So the parties were, almost all of the local municipalities that we studied, and we looked at 290, were able to meet the quite high quota requirement of selecting 50% of their candidates to be women. And those women that they found were actually exceedingly well qualified. We actually found that they were oftentimes more qualified than their male counterparts for elected office.
And do you know why they decided at this point to run for office, but they didn't before there was a quota?
I think what we know about women's underrepresentation in elected office is that it's a combination of supply and demand. So oftentimes we have fewer women that want to run for elected office, and that's because women oftentimes don't perceive themselves as being qualified. And they view qualifications as being really important. So that is, women don't see themselves as being good candidates, and so they don't come forward. On the other hand, we also know that demand is really important. So, and when I'm talking about demand, I'm talking about the desire of party elites to support female aspirants for elected office. And so the issue is that elites often don't encourage women to run, and men are much more likely to receive that encouragement. And so when we have a quota implemented and we tell elites, you know, as we tell party leaders, look, you have to go out and you have to find female candidates, they do so. And actually, we know even in the U.S. case, women are as likely as men to pursue elected office when they get that kind of encouragement.
Interesting. So the women were believing what people said about them, I guess male legislators, that you're just not qualified. So indeed they were qualified, but they were believing what other people labeled them as.
Exactly. Women, we also know, tend to be more deterred by the mechanics and the personal aspects of campaigning or serving in elected office. So, for example, women do say that they're more discouraged by the fact that they'd have to spend less time with their families, or they don't like the notion of having to engage in negative campaigns. I mean, but when we show women that politics is a space for women, so when women see other women running or when they see parties implementing quotas, they're more likely to perceive it as a viable option for them.
Mm. Do they have negative campaigns in Sweden?
Not like in the U.S.
I would imagine that it would be a little bit more civilized than what we have here. The other
Indeed.
Part of the study looked at whether or not having quotas could lead to stigmatization and backlash effects that could really undermine attempts to put more women in leadership roles. What did you find?
Yeah, so this was, of course, the driving concern for my co-author and I. So we're really worried that with a quota, you might get this immediate short-term gain, but to get that gain, that you'd actually be incurring long-term losses. So you'd get women into the lower level of politics, but because they had come in as quota women, that they might not be able to move up the ranks to positions that hold real power. And so we find actually that this isn't the case in Sweden. So looking at our data, we find that quota policies actually increase women's access to more powerful positions. And I've done some initial work looking across other Western European parties, and I found that that's also the case for those organizations. So actually having this kind of electoral affirmative action seems to subsequently increase women's access to leadership posts.
And what about backlash, particularly from male legislators? Are women accepted readily, or is there some backlash?
So we have mixed evidence on this front. So there are many instances where female politicians in the U.S. and also abroad report backlash. So they feel stigmatized or marginalized. Sometimes that's especially acutely felt by quota women, so that they're made to feel that they don't merit or deserve their post. But we actually see women, irrespective of whether they've been selected by quotas, sometimes face backlash and stigmatization. And I think oftentimes those women suggest that even if the quota does lead them to incur some backlash, they'd rather be in elected office than not. And so they are, that's a trade-off that they're willing to accept.
And is there, I know this isn't directly the focus, but I'm sure you know the answer to this, is there a difference in the kinds of issues that women as legislators are interested in and may bring to the forefront that men simply would not?
Oh, sure. And this has been one of the driving arguments in favor of quota policies. So we think that from a policy perspective, the absence of women from elected office has many negative consequences. So there's a great deal of evidence that suggests that female legislators are more likely to represent women's interests. So we expect that when we have more female assembly members, we're more likely to see the introduction of legislation related to women in particular. Some of my other work, which takes a really kind of international lens, also suggests that when political parties elect more women, those parties focus on a more diverse set of policy issues. So having more diverse perspectives in the party can actually lead to a more diverse policy agenda.
And you also talk about the importance of these parties, because party leaders, if you have women who are able to advance, are central political figures in advanced parliamentary democracies. How does the parliamentary part of that make a difference here?
Well, I mean, we're seeing this right now in the Brexit aftermath in the United Kingdom, for example. So David Cameron has told us that he's going to resign effective in October. And so because it's a parliamentary system, what's going to happen now is that the Conservative Party is going to select a new leader. So that's going to happen among its parliamentarians, and then they'll go to a vote of the broader membership. And when that person becomes leader of the Conservative Party, because the Conservative Party holds a majority of seats in Parliament, that person will become Prime Minister. And so actually what we're seeing is in the UK, our next Prime Minister will most likely be a woman. And so that's because the Conservative Party is going to select a female party leader.
We also have heard, and I just want your comment on this because I thought it was interesting, the New York Times, I'm sure you saw that over the weekend, had an article about what Hillary Clinton would do should she become president. I thought it was interesting. They were looking at her first 100 days, and the author, Patrick Healy, said in her first 100 days, she would tap women to make up half of her cabinet in hopes of bringing a new tone and collaborative sensibility to Washington. She, and I guess it's been in recent years a quarter to a third of cabinet positions have been held by women. That's interesting that they would highlight that half of her cabinet female.
Absolutely. Hillary Clinton has promised that if elected, she will have a parity cabinet. And so in this way, she's following in the footsteps of, for example, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Spain's José Zapatero, Italy's Matteo Renzi, and France's François Hollande. So we've seen in established democracies this growing trend towards saying that half of all cabinet ministers should be women. What's especially interesting for me is that we actually oftentimes see that it's male politicians that are able to appoint parity cabinet. It's not their female counterparts. And so it would be especially interesting to see Clinton do that as a female president.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's welcome phone calls from our audience and see what they think about this. I'm not sure how many of us are aware that there are a large number of countries that have gender quotas for helping to improve the representation of women in politics. And as a result, in the U.S., 19.4% of our members of Congress were female. In Afghanistan, of all places, it's 28% of their national legislators. In fact, there are many countries on the planet where there is a gender quota. We rank 83rd out of 137 countries for the share of women holding office in a national legislature. We've talked frequently on this program over the years about women running for office and having a more diverse and representative of our population in our national Congress and what it is that could be done to achieve that. Well, how about this idea? We haven't talked about it before. Gender quotas. Would it make sense? I think it would be a long haul to have this happen in the U.S., considering our debates over affirmative action. But would it make sense that there should be policies requiring a certain portion of political candidates or legislators be female? What do you think? Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we love to read your comments, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And what do you think of should Hillary Clinton win the presidency? She would be tapping, according to pretty good sources, women to make up half of her cabinet. Does it make sense to have, and women are over half the population in the United States, to have those numbers represented in Congress? Does it make a difference in terms of the issues that would be given attention to, the tone of the conversation, or do you think that it's going over the top? What do you think? Love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Question of the hour is, should we have a gender quota system to get more women in politics on a national level in the United States? Interestingly, it's happening in many other countries, and it has done just that. It's had an important effect in that it leads to leadership appointments within political parties. And our guest has been studying for a long time what's been going on in Sweden, where they've had this system for the past 15 years. Professor Diana O'Brien, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, is our guest. And our phone number, I would think you would have something to say about this, is 800-486-8655. I would imagine that there's also, we frequently talk about role models, and it's been true of so many women in other professions that there simply weren't a lot of role models. The number of women in Congress in this country is relatively low. I would think that more women would think about a career in politics if there were more women in politics, right?
We have evidence to suggest that that is, in fact, the case. So research shows that women's presence in politics fosters political engagement among female citizens and also actually enhances trust and satisfaction with the government. Female political leaders also inspire greater confidence in women's ability to govern. In particular, I'm thinking in reference to your question about a study from Switzerland that looked at the effects of women running for elected office and found that when a woman ran for office for the first time, it led other women to run for office in nearby municipalities. So there is evidence to suggest that we get a virtuous cycle. And once we have women holding these posts, more and more women become interested in politics.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if there was a lot of hoopla surrounding this in the countries that have gender quotas?
It's interesting. When quotas are initially adopted, they are sometimes controversial, though they often pass by very high margins when they're voted on in the legislature. What I have found is that over time, the controversy around quotas dies down and they become quite normalized. So, for example, in the British case, when the Labour Party first adopted its quota, it was actually sued by some of its male members for sex discrimination. And because it was sued, it actually had to temporarily halt its policy. Now, 20 years on, when I talk to Labour Party activists and politicians, the quota policy has become totally normalized. So they say, absolutely, we should have a quota policy. We think this is a good policy. We think this is important for the party. And we imagine that we'll continue to implement it moving forward. So in the space of 20 years, we've gone from deep controversy, lots of contention, to widespread agreement about this approach.
Mm-hmm. And has it been brought up at all by anybody in the United States? We just don't talk about this in this country, and it's happening in so many other places. That's unusual, isn't it?
It is unusual, and it's interesting. You've brought up the Afghani case twice, and actually the U.S. was supportive of the adoption of the quota in Afghanistan after our invasion in 2001. So we have also actually supported the implementation of quota policies abroad. In the U.S., though, our focus has been much more on alternative approaches to increasing women's representation. So, for example, we talk a lot more about candidate or campaign training for women and PACs that specifically focus on electing female candidates.
Mm. Here's a comment that's come on in from Teresa on Facebook. Most of the time, it feels like female politicians are put there to try to increase the number of female voters, which is insulting because they think that we'll vote female because we are female.
Yeah, so the concern here is maybe about tokenism, right? Mm-hmm. So the feeling that we have one woman who is supposed to stand for all women. The hope with something like a quota policy is that instead of having one or a small number of women, we actually increase women's representation so women hold, you know, 33% of seats or even 50% of seats in the legislature. And so then one female candidate or politician isn't expected to speak for all women, right? So women's presence becomes normalized.
Let's go to Joy in West Bend calling in. Hi, Joy.
Hi. Taking my call. I definitely think that we need a quota for women in politics and representation. I'm a 66-year-old woman who has participated in leadership in social justice groups, and to me it's happened over and over that the men informally rise to the top of the leadership. Women who propose ideas are kind of poo-pooed, and I think if we had more women's voices in representation, then men would be able to hear our ideas better. They would be able to listen to them and really look at them and see how what kind of advantage there would be. We definitely have a worldwide domination or oppression of women by men and really white men. And we need to move that along for the benefit of everyone.
And do you think quotas, and I'll ask this of our guest professor too, do you think quotas are the way to do that, the best way to do that, the only way to do that, Joy?
I don't know, but it's something to try. I mean, I you know, hesitate to try for a position of leadership in politics because it would be so difficult. It would be punishing to be in that position, but I'm certainly proud of every younger woman who tries to get into that position and you know, gets pummeled and stays there and increases the numbers of people. So if we had a quota, we certainly would be trying something. There is definitely more than 50% women worldwide. More men are born, but more women continue to live. Mm-hmm. So it's not fair to not have enough women in leadership.
Thanks, Joy, for your call. Professor O'Brien.
Well, first of all, I would encourage you, Joy, to think about running for elected office. So women don't get sufficient encouragement to do that. But if you have experience, for example, in other leadership posts, experience in your community, I would really, really just really encourage you to think about running. I think it's interesting what Joy says about the difficulties of articulating her opinion in predominantly male settings. So we have experimental research from political science that looks at the gender composition of groups and how that affects women's willingness and ability to talk. And what we do see is that when we have groups that are extremely male-dominated with only one or a small number of women, women speak much less than their male counterparts. And what we see as the number of women in the group increases, women are able to speak more. So that suggests that it is the case that when we have few women, women may be less able to make their voices heard.
Mm. And yet, when you look at, in my family, I'm told all the time that women talk more than men do, that we're more verbal than men are. That's probably true, isn't it? And yet, when you reach the political arena, you feel as though you can't speak as much? That's ironic.
Well, and actually, I think some of the empirical evidence suggests that the chatty woman is, in fact, a myth. Mm. So men often talk more than women. And it's interesting, men misperceive how much women speak. So men, the empirical data would suggest that men perceive that women spend much more time talking in group settings than they, in fact, do.
Mm. Let's go next to you. Thanks, Joy, so much for your call. Let's go to Jeremy in Racine next. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, from what I understand, affirmative action, if I'm not mistaken, is a form of, like, for companies to hire more minorities and or genders because either they don't have a proper balance or a substantial balance to make it equal opportunity. So when you want to talk about putting equal opportunity into a government position, are you stating that maybe we should force our government to have more women in Congress, even though if they're not qualified or not, just because we need to have more women? Or just to be more diverse?
So it's interesting the way in which quotas are applied. So in some cases, many of our Western European counterparts, the parties themselves choose to do this. So this is totally voluntary. In other countries, in fact, most Latin American states, parties actually are mandated to select female candidates. And if they don't include enough women on their list of candidates, those lists will be disqualified or the parties will be otherwise punished. So in those cases, the parties are indeed being told that they have to select women. We don't see evidence in any case that I can think of that those women that get selected are less qualified for elected office. So again, on metrics like previous experience and performance when they are in the post, those women seem to be as or more qualified oftentimes than their male counterparts. But oftentimes we do get this kind of visceral response from voters, particularly as we debate quotas before they've been implemented, around questions of fairness and merit. So I don't think that Jeremy would at all be alone in articulating that concern.
Mm-hmm. So in all of the countries that have gender quotas, were there debates in the legislature and it had to be an up and down vote as to whether or not to have these?
Quotas come from a lot of different places. So yes, basically, in almost every case where we have a quota, the national legislature has decided to implement that quota. My hesitancy there is that we sometimes have post-conflict countries or countries that are in the middle of a major regime transition where the quota is adopted in that in-between period, right, between governments. But quotas are not, quotas come in with a mandate from elected officials, typically, yes.
Thanks for your call, Jeremy. Jimmy is next in Boulder Junction. Hi.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I had a question. I missed the first part of the program, and maybe this is explained. So functionally, let's say you're having a congressional election, and Wisconsin has 8, I believe, now? Yeah, congressional districts. How would you make sure that whatever percentage of females that you wanted in the House of Representatives were actually going to get the positions? I'm a little shaky on how the whole system would work.
Okay.
That is a great question. And so at the beginning of the program, I said that I thought actually the main barrier towards quotas in the U.S. was not, in fact, really public opinion, but it had to do with how we select our candidates and our electoral system. So you're absolutely touching on one of the major issues here. In the U.S., each party can only run one candidate per district. Right. And in many of the countries that implement quotas, this isn't the case. There are multiple representatives per district so that we can run both men and women. In the U.S., it really has this zero-sum feel. So to tell a party you have to select a female candidate means that you can't select a man. Where how quotas have been implemented in countries like the U.S., where we only have one representative per district, each party can only run one candidate for the seat, is typically we'll do some sort of twinning. So we'll tell political parties or political parties will decide, okay, we will pair up these two districts. In one we'll run a man, in the other we'll run a woman. Or somewhere like the United Kingdom, the Labour Party there, which is the left-leaning party, they say, okay, we're going to go ahead and reserve half of our winnable seats for female candidates. So we're actually only going to consider female candidates for these seats. So I think Americans often feel really uncomfortable with that because that gives parties much more control over candidate selection. Mm-hmm. And in the U.S., we're used to having primaries where voters really weigh in on candidate selection. And so the notion of, for example, a party saying, well, we're only going to have female candidates in this primary, maybe makes people feel a little uncomfortable. But maybe some the kind of quota alternative we might imagine would be that parties are expected to make sure that they have at least one viable female candidate running in the primary.
Hmm. Thanks very much for a good question, Jimmy. Let's go to Karen in Winona, Minnesota. Hi.
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 When Justin Trudeau was elected Prime Minister of Canada in 2015, he formed his cabinet with gender parity, half women, half men. And when people asked him why, he said, because it's 2015 and women are half of the human race. I say go, Justin, and I say go, women. Thanks.
Thanks very much for the call, Karen.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the only way that, because it would be somewhat complicated for parties because of the way we elect people to Congress in this country, so different from many of the countries that have gender parity, that it does, that maybe the push in this country needs to be that, I don't know, half of the school board should be female, that half of the cabinet positions should be female, that in places where this could be accomplished, it should be a discussion that's on the table.
Absolutely. So then the thought is about looking for places where we could implement quotas to build a pipeline, right? So, and I think that's a great point. So if we have women in lower level elected office, then they can move into these higher positions. I mean, the really radical solution, of course, would be to reserve seats for women in Congress. So there are countries that set aside seats for women in their parliaments or their legislatures. That's actually how the Afghani quota works. So they set aside seats for women. So I suppose if Jerry and others were willing, you could expand the size of Congress and say, well, these seats are seats that can only be held by women and only be contested by women. Short of doing that, obviously, there are these less radical solutions, like encouraging women to get into lower-level elected office, like focusing on campaign training programs, like focusing on political action committees.
Has it made a difference in countries like Sweden in terms of recruiting young women? Have you noticed that young women think naturally of career in politics now, whereas before 1995 they may not have?
Our evidence looking across countries is that when we have more women in elected office, both women and adolescent girls respond that they're much more interested in politics, that they're much more likely to discuss politics, like they're much more likely to see politics as a viable career. So there's all sorts of evidence of these role model effects.
Thanks, Karen, very much for your call. We'll take more in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Diana O'Brien, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, and she has done a major study of gender quotas and looking specifically at Sweden, where the largest political party, Swedish Social Democratic Party, imposed a gender quota on 290 municipal branches of the party in 1994. But Sweden isn't alone. There are all kinds of countries that have gender quotas. We don't. perhaps because we don't, we have many fewer women in our Congress than do places like Sweden and Afghanistan and all kinds of other countries on Earth. Do we need to do something about it? It would be hard to do gender quotas in Congress, but there could be a way to do that. Does it make sense to have a certain number of seats need to be for women? And should we be doing that, modeling ourselves on a Swedish kind of model or not? What do you think? Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, so reach us either of those ways. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655. Let's go back to phone calls and to Tara in La Crosse. Hi, Tara.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I'm just calling to say that at least on the left side of the state over in La Crosse, I happen to be the chair of the La Crosse County Board of Supervisors. We have a number of female county board supervisors who are also in other leadership positions. Our state senator, Jennifer Schilling, is the minority leader in the Wisconsin State Senate. And I guess I really just want to mention that, brag about us a little bit, if you will, but also talk to the point that the professor made, that I do think it came over time. You know, it happened over time, and having been on the board since 2000, it has definitely shifted as more females have gotten elected to the La Crosse County Board. So I would definitely reinforce the point that she made, that you kind of get a critical mass of females in a body like a county board, and it makes a huge difference.
And did all of that happen, Tara, rather gradually, or was there some push to get women to run for office? What happened?
A couple of things. I think most of it was gradual but intentional, if you will, that we recruited, you know, as once I got on the board and there were a few other females who were elected in the early 2000s, we looked for other people to run. You know, these are two-year terms, so we are constantly looking for our friends and colleagues who might serve as well and might be willing to run. And, you know, kind of success breeds success on this issue. The other thing for me personally is that I'm a graduate of the Emerge Wisconsin program, which is a training program for females who are Democrats who want to run for office and get elected. And that's a program that's been around for about 10 years in Wisconsin. It's, you know, it's in other states as well, Kentucky and around the country. We're one of several Emerge programs. And that has definitely had an impact on me. We have recruited several people in La Crosse to run for office, and they are also alumni of the Emerge Wisconsin program. So that has helped us as well.
Yeah, interesting. Professor O'Brien, maybe you need to study La Crosse next, huh?
Well, I'm just so grateful for Tara's, first of all, service to the state, but also for her phone call, because I think it brings up some great points. So Tara talks about how more women have been elected over time, and she said, look, we went and we recruited other women to run for office. And I realize I've been talking about this virtuous cycle in terms of role modeling. So women just see other women in elected office and they think, okay, politics is for me. But part of what happens is once we get women into elected office, they bring other women with them. So women have networks, for example, that contain other great politically minded, qualified women. And so once we get women into leadership positions where they're in a position to recruit, so when we think about, for example, county party leaders, female county party leaders are more likely to reach out for two women. And so this is an important way that we increase the pipeline of women, not just for kind of local elected office, but then to move up into state and eventually national level positions. Mm.
Thank you so much for your call. Interesting to hear from you. John in Eau Claire, hi.
Yes. I'm just curious, why not take it to the next step and take the percentage of each minority whether they be female, black, Asian, doesn't matter, and go for quotas, quota set there. Why stop with just male versus female?
So it is interesting. We've been talking about quotas with respect to women, and if we look globally, women are the group that have benefited the most or been most likely to receive quota policies aimed at increasing their presence in elected office. But we actually do see cases where we see quotas for other groups. So I can think of instances where we have quotas for ethnic minorities, for example, who have been historically underrepresented. Or even now, I can think of a Turkish political party that recently implemented a quota for LGBT individuals. So it's not the case that that quotas only apply to women. When we think about why is it that women have been the group that has been targeted most for quota policies, I think it's that globally people can see that women are 51% of the population. And when we had this initial kind of wave or surge of the adoption of quota policies in the 1990s, there was no country in the world where women were represented at that level. So there's no country in the world where women held 50% of seats in the legislature. And so people started to ask, why is it that women are so radically underrepresented? Why, if women are 51% of the population in the U.S., do they only hold 20% of the seats? And so I think that disconnect, so seeing that women make up so much of the population and are so radically underrepresented, has been the reason why women have been the kind of primary target for these policies.
Is there some level of government in this country, Professor O'Brien, where women are represented in equal numbers to where they are in the population?
So I can't think of in any sort of national level position where women are equally well represented. So not in the cabinet, not on the Supreme Court or the federal courts, not in Congress. What we do know is that as we get closer and closer to home, so as we move down the ladder to, for example, local government posts, we see many more women in elected office. So I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility to actually see, for example, school boards where women make up maybe even a majority of the members of the board. But in any sort of even state house or assembly, mayors, statewide elected offices, in all of those instances, women are underrepresented.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call, John. Tony in Stevens Point. Hi.
Hey. I'm curious. Women have 51% of the voting population in the United States, and we're trying to force women into office, it seems like, when apparently the women themselves don't want them in there, and we'll probably find out more about that in November when we'll be voting on a woman, and probably, I would guess 40% of women won't vote for her. So it doesn't really make sense. If they don't want to be there themselves or they don't want other women in there, this doesn't make sense to me. So I'll go off the line and take your answer.
All right, Tony.
Yeah, so I think maybe Tony raises two interesting points. So the first is just do women themselves want quota policies? Right. So do we think that a majority of American women would support quotas for women in elected office? So the public opinion data that I can think about cross-nationally suggests that female voters and women in the electorate are more likely than men to support quota policies or policies aimed at increasing women's presence in elected office. But certainly not all women are in support of those policies. The second point is one about, do women themselves want to hold elected office? So again, we're coming back here to this question of supply versus demand. And it is the case that, again, women feel less qualified to run for elected office and are less likely to put themselves forward. But again, we also know that that gap in ambition closes when women are encouraged to run. So when sitting politicians, when party leaders, when people like Tara reach out and encourage women to stand for office, women are just as likely as men to express interest in doing so.
Mm. Is there anything in particular you're going to be studying with the nomination of Hillary Clinton to be, well, she will be the nominee of the Democratic Party. In this particular election, when you have the first major party candidate, a woman, what will you be looking at in this country? Will you look at any of those things that our caller just talked about, whether or not women are going to vote for her? Is that important to know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this opens up a whole set of questions for women in politics scholars. And in fact, not just, so of course, in this country, having Hillary Clinton be the Democratic candidate, the possibility of a female president in the U.S., coupled with a female chancellor in Germany and a female prime minister in the U.K. will be unprecedented. Mm-hmm. So to have three of the most important countries in the world led by women, it's going to open up all sorts of questions about whether there are policy implications here. So do we expect that women will govern differently than men in this chief executive position? Or do we expect that they will behave like their male counterparts? Do we think that they have a unique perspective on policy? Do we think that there are consequences for public opinion? So, for example, evidence from looking at women's presence in legislatures suggests that having women in elected office makes women in the electorate believe that female politicians are more competent and more qualified. So do we see those kind of broader effects? I think those are questions that have always been important to women in politics scholars, but are going to come to the forefront in the coming weeks and months.
Let's go to Carl in Madison next. Hi, Carl.
Yes, Kathleen, I'm going to miss your program. We're moving to Oregon. I'll have to
really?
Look y'all up on the Internet.
Oh.
But I just wanted to say, boy, there's a couple of things. One, if you just look at the state of the world and the typically the men who have run it, boy, by that standard alone, it's time to at least share the wheel. And then I think the other thing is I was a male kindergarten teacher for a number of years, the first guy, the only guy in the 100-year history of my public school to teach kindergarten. And while I didn't face the kind of discrimination as a man entering primarily a women's field, as I think many women do entering a man's field, I still felt cautious about a guy in a position like that. And can I bring my whole self? Can I be just who I am? Do I have to telegraph certain things about who I am and what my intentions are because it's so new and because maybe eyebrows will be raised? And I think as more women enter into the political discourse at the national level and see themselves not having to represent, you know, am I hawk enough or am I, you know, if they can just be themselves and not have to represent all women in their, you know, few seats, I think we'll get better representation because I think it'll free us up to be who we truly are. And I think who we truly are is better than the political discourse across the airwaves right now.
Hmm. Thanks, Carl. Have a good move and stay in touch via computer.
I will. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. Professor O'Brien.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that Carl brings up the state of the world and for example, hawkishness and maybe the need to have just more diversity in politics. So I've done some work looking at female ministers of defense, for example.
Mm.
And actually what we see with female defense ministers is they're oftentimes more hawkish than their male counterparts. So they will increase defense spending, for example. And I think that actually comes to Carl's point about how he felt as being a male kindergarten teacher in a predominantly female field. So he felt kind of cautious about what he was telegraphing and how he should behave. And so there's this way in which we place a lot of burden on female politicians when their numbers are small. So on the one hand, we want them to meet or exceed the expectations set by male politicians. So we want them to be hawkish and assertive and aggressive. On the other hand, we expect them to also be the voice of women and place women's issues on the agenda and articulate those concerns. And so I think Carl is right that if we can get a critical mass of women as opposed to a token, we create opportunities for female politicians to focus on the issues that are most important to them, whether they're gendered issues or not.
Thanks, Carol, very much for your call. That's it for the show. Thank you so much, Professor O'Brien, for introducing a new area of discussion to us. It was a good hour and informative. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Professor Diana O'Brien is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Indiana University and has been studying gender quota with an emphasis on Sweden for a number of years. where they've had gender quota. Coming up on Monday at this time, we're going to talk with someone who says that professors are overwhelmingly liberal on campuses around the country. We'll explore the idea that perhaps universities need to change hiring practices and hire more conservative professors, perhaps through some form of affirmative action. Neil Gross will be our guest, author of Why Are Professors Liberal and Why Do Conservatives Care? Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to Carrie Salinas for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up, and then Franz DeWall will be joining us to talk about the intelligence, and oh, we're going to learn so many interesting things, the intelligence of animals.